Hi, I'm Loretta Nostville from the Department of Lymphoma Myeloma, University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. It is my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Catherine Diefenbach, also NYU Director of the Hematology Translational Research and Director of the Clinical Lymphoma Program in the Perlmutter Cancer Center. Today, we're going to do a faculty roundtable on CAR T-cell therapies, bispecific antibodies, and antibody-drug conjugates in follicular lymphoma. Okay, so I'm going to kick off this webinar and just give you an overview of follicular lymphoma, and then we'll spend a good portion of the time having Dr. Diefenbach walk us through some of the latest developments as it pertains to T-cell engagers and antibody-drug conjugates. So the first thing to recognize is follicular lymphoma is a very heterogeneous disease. Some patients will present with limited stage, so that's the minority. The majority will actually present with advanced stage. Some of those patients will be asymptomatic versus others may be grossly symptomatic, and that does not always correlate with the amount of disease burden in my experience. And so then what are the goals of our treatment and how do we put this into context given the heterogeneity of presentation and the clinical course over time? I think it's important that we always want to maximize our efficacy while reducing the potential negative impact on quality of life as it pertains to toxicity. Obviously, we want patients to have a long, normal lifespan. And so what is going to potentially put them at risk for that not being true? Usually it's disease progression, transformation, or potentially treatment-related toxicity. So we balance that, again, with the efficacy of a given therapy and hopefully a reduced impact on quality of life. When we consider follicular lymphoma, there is also heterogeneity in terms of the histology and grading. You can see here the classic phenotype as described by immunohistochemistry or flow cytometry markers. So this is a germinal center derived B-cell lymphoma. Sort of the hallmark is translocation 14-18. And though this is generally present on the vast majority of cases, it's not necessary for all patients to be diagnosed with follicular, just a very common finding. Grading is also somewhat controversial in that it's quite subjective. The difference between grade 1 and 2 is not clinically significant, so generally we oftentimes will lump them together. Grade 3A is designated by the number of sideroblasts per high-power field, and distinguishing 3B from diffuse large B-cell lymphoma requires a skilled hematopathologist. So again, though it's relevant to understand the grading of follicular lymphoma, placing a large amount of decision based off of this finding, I think is probably not well supported just based off of the subjectivity of this determination. It's also important to spend some time talking about, well, when do we start treatment? Because there's also heterogeneity in terms of clinical practice. But for most of our prospective studies, it's pretty clear that for frontline patients, having one of these criteria, either the GELF or modified GELF, as has been modified three times over the last few decades, or the BNLI criteria, having one of these criteria suggests that it's probably no longer safe to observe patients. You can see here those symptoms is included in both of these criteria. Again, in clinical practice, in my experience, it's not the majority of patients that have symptoms. So relying that solely is probably not a good practice either. It would be really helpful to do a better job of risk stratifying patients given the number of treatment options available. So not only just determining do they need treatment or are they appropriate for observation, but how aggressive should we be with that treatment? And there are a number of clinical tools available to us to try and risk stratify patients. At diagnosis, there are a number of clinical prognostic models such as FLIPI, FLIPI2, the PRIMA PI. An attempt to incorporate biology into these risk scores include the M7 FLIPI or the PRIMA23 gene. Though those can be helpful, they're not often readily available in the clinic given some of that information may not be available to most clinicians. And so PET CT, for instance, in addition to the FLIPI score, is probably some of the more common tools used to try and identify who's appropriate for therapy and what does their 5 and 10 year survival rates look like. The other time point to risk stratify patients is the end of induction. So a PET CR at the end of chemoimmunotherapy has been associated with prolonged PFS and even improvement in overall survival. So it's another time point that we may have a tool to help risk stratify patients. And then a progression event within 24 months may designate higher risk patients and currently identifies one of the greatest unmet needs. Tools that are being studied but not currently available to inform either risk or management strategies include circulating tumor DNA. So hopefully in the next few years, these tools will also be included into this sort of paradigm for how we might risk stratify patients and inform treatment selection. So these are the current dilemmas in frontline. Should I still watch and wait in the modern era? If I'm going to use chemoimmunotherapy, what's the optimal chemotherapy backbone? Does the CD20 matter, such as rituximab or obinutuzumab? And now we have CD20, CD3 bispecific antibodies available in that third line or later setting that will likely move into earlier lines. Should you continue the CD20 directed therapy for an extended period of time in the form of maintenance? And then are there chemo-free options that are attractive for frontline follicular lymphoma? So the first question about should we still observe patients in the modern era, the short answer is yes, and that's based off of the Ardeshna study that demonstrated there's a good portion of patients at 10 years still have not been treated with follicular lymphoma if they were randomized to the observation arm. On average, the median time to treatment is about 2.5 years, but again, the overall survival in this group is still no different. Obviously, if you initiate treatment with single-agent rituximab, you're going to delay that first progression event. So there are some patients where the psychology of having a cancer that's being observed may be more detrimental to them than not treating the lymphoma. So if you're going to treat someone with low tumor burden, I think single agent rituximab is a reasonable consideration, but it's still appropriate to observe patients in the modern era. For patients who have high tumor burden or in need of systemic therapy, you have three chemotherapy backbone options that have been studied across a number of trials. So the differences in the efficacy of the different chemo backbones, really probably about the only difference, is an improvement in progression-free survival in the STIL study that looked at bendamustine rituximab versus R-CHOP. Again, no difference in overall survival. And in the BRIGHT study, bendamustine rituximab was not inferior to R-CHOP or RCVP. So I think you could use any of those options if you're considering chemotherapy. An important positive phase 3 study is the Gallium trial that set out to determine was obinutuzumab a superior antibody to rituximab. Some important features of how the study was conducted in that as a center, the chemotherapy backbone was established. It was not sort of selected based off of patient-specific characteristics, and that may have introduced some variables that impacted some of the findings. Nonetheless, when we look at now a more mature follow-up of the Gallium study, obinutuzumab when combined with chemotherapy, either bendamustine, CHOP, or CVP, did result in significant improvement in progression-free survival, albeit a modest improvement and no difference in overall survival. Slightly higher rates of grade 3 or higher infusion reaction or neutropenia in the obinutuzumab-containing arm. So again, it is a risk-benefit discussion. Should all patients get maintenance? That was not a question answered by the Gallium study. All patients that had at least a partial response after chemoimmunotherapy induction did go on to receive additional 2 years of maintenance. With the PRIMA study, which one of the limitations of this trial, there was no bendamustine in the induction. By continuing rituximab maintenance for 2 additional years after induction did result in a significant improvement in PFS of about 10.5 years versus about 4 years if patients were observed. But again, despite that dramatic difference, still no difference in overall survival. In the era of COVID, I think it was a little bit harder to justify continuing CD20 exposure in patients that were in a response, particularly given the potential risk of infectious complications. Nonetheless, you can extend the PFS by quite a long time with maintenance rituximab. Is there a non-chemo option? Well, the relevant study set out to answer that question. These were high tumor burden advanced stage follicular lymphoma patients randomized to either lenalidomide and rituximab versus rituximab and chemo, followed by 2 years of maintenance. The experimental arm had 18 cycles of the combination. Now, there was a dose adjustment based off a response after the first 6 cycles where patients could be dose reduced if they were in a CR with lenalidomide down to 10 milligrams starting at 20. And then again, rituximab after 18 cycles continued as monotherapy, so that the end point on both arms was similar. What we found, there was absolutely no difference in progression-free survival or overall survival. And though there was potentially some safety advantages in the lenalidomide rituximab arm, less grade 3 or higher neutropenias and a much lower rate of prophylactic growth factor use, There was higher cutaneous reactions, such as rash in the lenalidomide-containing arm. So at the end of the day, this was a negative study, but it was at least intriguing that a non-chemo option had pretty similar efficacy in this large randomized phase 3 study. So to summarize frontline, you have several options, none of which have resulted in a significant difference in overall survival. So they're all reasonable options. For low tumor burden patients, observation is still appropriate. For high tumor burden patients, chemoimmunotherapy is probably one of the most common approaches, and you can choose your chemo based off of patient-specific characteristics and their goals of treatment. When we move into the relapse refractory setting, that's probably where more changes have emerged in the last few years. Historically, we have viewed this disease as one of a relapsing and remitting disease, with remission durations getting shorter and shorter with subsequent lines of therapy. And that was still true in the rituximab era. This was an observational cohort reported on by Brian Link, suggesting that yes, once we get into that second line and later, particularly third line and later, most PFS estimates are going to be around a year. Can we do better at risk stratifying other than just approaching all relapsed refractory patients equally? One way to potentially risk stratify patients, as I alluded to, is a progression event within 24 months. So this was an observational study reported by Carla Casullo, suggesting that patients who had chemoimmunotherapy up front, including R-CHOP, if they experienced a progression event within 2 years, their median overall survival is about 5 years. Whereas the other group of patients, which was about 80% of her cohort, if they experienced a progression event beyond that 24-month or not at all, their overall survival is the same as an age-sex-matched cohort of patients, suggesting those patients are going to do very well. Those that relapse early are going to be facing much far inferior outcomes. And one of the limitations of this study is that biopsies were not routinely done to confirm that this was still follicular, not transformation, for instance. The vast majority had R-CHOP, and so how does this apply to the gallium data, for instance, or bendamustine cohort? So there have been other data sets looking into this. And in general, the outcomes are still poor for those with relapsed follicular lymphoma within 24 months. Probably the greatest unmet need is third line and beyond. And this just illustrates that the treatment can be so heterogeneous. So once we start walking you through some of the emerging data, recognize that how patients got to third line can be grossly different, some of which can be rituximab monotherapy. Some may have had two different courses of chemoimmunotherapy. And so again, it's hard to generalize outcomes across all these studies, but it does at least, I can conclude that the unmet need is for third line and beyond for follicular lymphoma. I'm going to start the discussion in this space by covering CAR T-cell therapy. So just to remind everyone, this does require patients be identified as appropriate candidates for CAR because we use an autologous product. They have to undergo leukapheresis, and then manufacturing occurs currently using a viral vector to introduce the extracellular material that's going to bind CD19, which is on the surface of malignant B cells and normal B cells, to grow up in culture. There's this, an additional modification that they have two co-stimulatory domains that once they engage their target, they're more primed to release cytokines, expand, and bring in other immune cell reinforcement to that site. Once they undergo a quality check, they're sent back to the originating site. Patients have to undergo lymphocyte depleting chemotherapy and then cell infusion. Then they're monitored for the first 30 days for acute toxicity. ZUMA-5 led to FDA approval of axi-cel for relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma after two prior lines of therapy. So to qualify for the single-arm phase 2 study, patients had to have at least two prior lines of therapy that included an alkylator and CD20 antibody. They were young for a follicular cohort, pretty heavily pretreated. Most were refractory to their last line of therapy and over-enriched for POD24 status, suggesting again, for this more intensive approach, those were the types of patients with follicular lymphoma that were considered for this treatment. Despite that, the response rates are quite high. You can see 79% of this cohort of a little over 100 patients achieved a complete response, very few patients with stable disease. And that did appear to be durable. So we did see updates this year at ASH with 3 years of median follow-up now. Again, quite impressive progression-free survival, duration response, and overall survival for this heavily pretreated cohort of patients. And if you look closely at the follicular lymphoma, it's about a median PFS of about 40 months for patients who received axi-cel in that third line or later setting. when we look across subgroups, the POD24 patients, which is viewed to be a great unmet need, you can see the median PFS was about 40 months in that group, because again, that was the majority of patients included in the study. And those that didn't have this high or were not this high risk designation did even better, median PFS not reached. Now, you can't talk about CAR T and not at least recognize the acute toxicity, cytokine release syndrome, and ICANS or neurologic events, which are toxicities associated with cellular therapies that generally occur within the first 1 to 2 weeks. And you can see here, looking at specifically the follicular cohort in this study, you can't compare cross studies, but at least in my experience, a little bit lower rates of grade 3 or higher CRS or ICANS with axi-cel and follicular than what we might expect in more aggressive lymphoma subtypes. That being said, still 15% experienced grade 3 or higher ICANS. About a third of patients received corticosteroids to address these acute toxicities. This was an attempt to try and identify how does this compare to the current treatment landscape. So this was a retrospective cohort of patients treated with standard of care therapies, many of which were enrolled from outside of the U.S., so there were patients treated in the U.S. I mention that because the treatment options are going to be so vastly different depending on where you recruit these patients. And you can see how many prior lines of therapy and what those lines of therapy, just illustrating how heterogeneous the treatment options are for patients with follicular lymphoma. But when we look at this retrospective comparison of the outcomes observed in the ZUMA-5 versus what was achieved with standard of care therapies for this patient group, you can see it does appear that axi-cel can result in quite favorable outcomes and will likely compete quite favorably with the treatment landscape. And a randomized study is underway currently looking at axi-cel versus R-squared, BR, or R-CHOP. Here is the second FDA-approved CAR T-cell therapy, Tisagen Leclusal, or Tisa-cel, for relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. Similar eligibility criteria in that patients had to have had at least two prior lines of therapy that included an alkylator and CD20 antibody. And you can see here quite favorable progression-free survival, median PFS of about 30 months, quite favorable overall survival, and quite notable complete response rate of about 69%. Most notable to me is that the toxicity looks to be very favorable. No grade 3 or higher CRS, and only 1% experienced a grade 3 or higher ICANS that did fully resolve. Again, when we saw updates this year at ASH across a number of poor risk subgroups, including POD24, bulky disease, double refractory, high FLIPI score, you can see here we still see quite favorable responses, maybe about the only outliers of the high metabolic tumor volume, maybe not quite as good CR rate. But again, quite impressive given these high-risk features and high-risk population. Similar to what was done in SCHOLAR-5, an attempt to try and explore how Tisa-cel might compete in the treatment landscape. So again, the outcomes look to be quite favorable with Tisa-cel versus what may be achieved with other standard of care options. And there are a number of ongoing clinical trials exploring CAR T or cellular therapies, including allogeneic CAR, CARs for patients with relapsed or refractory follicular lymphoma, so stay tuned. We have to also acknowledge the late toxicities associated with CAR T as it pertains to eradicating CD19 positive cells, including B cell aplasia or hypogammaglobulinemia that occurs in about half of patients that can extend well beyond 1 to 2 years. And so monitoring IgG levels, making sure patients are up to date on prophylactic strategies such as HSV, PJP prophylaxis for at least a year or until CD4 counts recover beyond 200. And then about a 25 to 30% of patients will have prolonged cytopenias that extend well beyond the first 30 days. And so again, making sure that they're aware of potential bacterial and viral infections. The practical guidance on that is again somewhat controversial because we don't have a consensus on this, but some places will replace IVIG when IgG levels drop below 400. Again, it's our practice generally to maintain HSV and PJP prophylaxis until CD4 count is greater than 200 or a year, and then make sure patients are up to date on vaccinations. So again, I'll conclude in terms of the heterogeneity and frontline. All the variable treatment options available to patients. So that generally requires an in-depth discussion about the potential risks and benefits and personalizing the treatment choice based off of patient and disease characteristics. balancing that with their goals of therapy. So now I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Diefenbach to talk about some of the new emerging therapies that are quite exciting.
Thank you, Dr. Nastipol, and now I'll go on. Hi, I'm going to talk to you guys about immune targets and therapies in lymphoma. So we're going to talk, I think Dr. Nastipol has very artfully talked about CAR T cells, but there are many other targets on lymphoma cells that are worth targeting in an immunologic perspective. Here are some. So just to conceptualize what these therapies do, bispecific antibodies are antibodies that have two arms rather than one. And one arm, as you can see in this picture, grabs on to the antigen that's on the surface of the lymphoma cell, but the other arm grabs on to an antigen on the surface of a T cell, often CD3, and basically brings the T cell into proximity of the lymphoma cell and says, look, lymphoma cell, here's a foreign lymphoma cell. Eat this cell, get rid of it, destroy it. And thus the proximity is more stimulating to the T cells than if they're just floating around in the milieu and not recognizing the lymphoma cells. Then we have monoclonal antibodies such as Rituxan, which are just antigen-antibody single conjugation, and that usually will stimulate something like cytotoxicity through ADCC. Bispecific antibodies, in consequence, are very interesting because what they do is they use the antigen-antibody binding of a monoclonal antibody as a mechanism for delivery of a chemotherapy moiety. And here are some monoclonal antibodies that you know, such as Rituxan or tafasitamab. Antibody drug conjugates, such as polatuzumab, which I'm going to talk to you about today, target an antigen that's on the surface of the T cell or the B cell, in this case CD79B, which is on the surface of the B cell, and uses this antigen-antibody binding to deliver a microtubule disrupting toxin, in this case MMAE, directly to the tumor cells. So it is, if you will, a Trojan horse. It is not itself the antigen-antibody binding that causes the therapeutic effect, but the byproduct of the antigen-antibody binding, which is the opsonization of the chemotherapy moiety. So polatuzumab was looked at in combination with bendamustine in large cell lymphoma. And this is now a combination of, in the follicular population, of polatuzumab with obinutuzumab, the monoclonal antibody, and lenalidomide in combination in follicular lymphoma. And I'll report to you the final safety and efficacy results from the phase 1b2 study that were reported in ASH this year. So this was a single arm phase 1b2 study in which patients received polatuzumab at either 1.4 or 1.8 mg per kg, lenalidomide in escalating doses, and obinutuzumab at standard dose of 1,000 milligrams. The recommended phase 2 dose was 20 of len and 1.4 of pola with 1,000 milligrams of len. In induction, patients received 6 cycles of therapy. Patients who then had a CR, PRSD, clinical benefit, were able to move on to maintenance, where they got obinutuzumab once every 2 months for 24 months and lenalidomide daily for 21 of 28 days. The primary endpoint was IRC-SSCR at the end of induction, measured by PET CT scans, and secondary endpoints included overall response, PFS, OS, and biomarker analysis. In the final analysis population, the efficacy evaluable population was 46 patients, with a median duration of follow-up now of 43.3 months. And similar to the patients that Dr. Nastipol described, these were extremely heavily pretreated patients. So a full one-third of them were POD24 positive, and 71% of them were refractory to any line of CD20 therapy. They had a median of 3 prior lines of therapy with a range of 3 to 7. Almost 60% were refractory to their last prior therapy. And I think what is different about this in the CAR T population is that these were older patients. So their median age was 62, with patients as old as 87 being treated on this study. In terms of any grade AEs were observed in 12.5% of patients. The primary AEs that were seen were hematologic AEs, primarily neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, which are known toxicities of lenalidomide, particularly, and anemia. There were also infusion reactions, primarily to the obinutuzumab, peripheral neuropathy, which is a known toxicity of the polatuzumab. With regard to grade 3 and 4 AEs, the primary grade 3 and 4 AEs were either hematologic or infections. Once we instituted prophylaxis with G-CSF, the number of infections went down substantially, and 55% of patients received G-CSF during induction, and 36% then required it during maintenance. However, only despite the fact that 14 patients had grade 3 thrombocytopenia, only 2 patients needed platelet transfusions, and only 8 patients had grade 3 anemia. In terms of secondary malignancies, these were patients who were on maintenance therapy. We had 2 patients who had squamous cell carcinoma, 1 patient who had a prior history of lung cancer, had a likely relapse, and 1 patient who was very heavily pretreated ended up developing myelodysplastic syndrome. With our end of response analysis by Lugano 2014, which did not require bone marrows, the complete response rate was 74%, with an overall response rate of 83%. We had several patients who were downgraded because they didn't have a follow-up bone marrow, which gave a still very impressive overall response rate of 76% by IRC with a CR rate of 61%. And this was our waterfall plot. Progression-free survival now with 3.6 years of follow-up has not been reached, and the landmark PFS at 48 months is 53.4%. So a therapy that is effective in heavily pretreated patients with really minimal toxicity given completely outpatient, with a PFS now at more than 3 years, more than half of patients remain in remission. And overall survival was excellent. So with extended follow-up, the safety profiles continued to be consistent with the known profiles of individual drugs, and there were no new safety signals. The novel triplet combination elicited high CR rates at end of induction in a heavily pretreated and refractory population, and PFS was not reached with 53% of patients remaining progression-free now at 48 months. Let's talk now about bispecific T-cell engagers, or BiTEs. So there are really 4 BiTEs that are commercially under investigation, at least. These are the first 4. Mosunetuzumab was engineered to bind to CD20 on B cells and CD3 on T cells. Glofitamab, which is used primarily for large cell lymphoma, is a novel T-cell engaging bispecific with a unique 2-to-1 molecular configuration that has superior potency but also higher toxicity. And the dual targeting results in T-cell activation, proliferation, and CD20-bearing T-cell killing, B-cell killing. Mosunetuzumab is a first-in-class. It's now been granted accelerated approval to third-line follicular lymphoma. And in a single-agent study, the overall response rate was 80% with 60% CR rate, with the majority maintaining their response after 18 months. There was consistent benefit in patients with double refractory disease who were POD24 positive. And mosunetuzumab is a fixed duration treatment that can be administered in the outpatient setting. So this is now some updated results now after 28.3 months of follow-up. So this was their pivotal phase 2 design. More than 2 prior therapies required. Mosunetuzumab is administered in step-up dosing, and this is actually very important because I think you saw Dr. Nastupal describe some of the toxicities of CAR T cells, particularly the CRS and the neurotox that requires them to be in the hospital. So we found that when you give small doses of these bispecifics and ramp up to a full dose, you can mitigate a lot of the CRS toxicity that was previously associated with them. So you start at 1 milligram, and then you give 2 milligrams, and then you give full dose. And when this was done, then patients received fixed duration treatment. They got 8 cycles if a CR. If no CR, they were able to be treated for up to 17 months, and they did not need to be hospitalized. Again, these were very refractory patients on the elderly side, with the oldest patient being 90 years old, and a median age of 60, and 52% POD24 positive. The safety profile, and I think it's interesting to contrast this really with CAR Ts, as they're really the other very potent therapy. There were 2% grade 5 AEs. One was progression of disease, and one was an unexplained death. Here's the CRS summary. So CRS, any grade. Grade 1 is 26% and grade 2 is 17%. You can see that only 1% of patients had a higher CRS. The median time to CRS is short, and the median CRS duration is also short. 11% of patients required corticosteroids, but only 8% of patients required TOSI, and all events resolved. And there were no, you can see that there's, quite a few CRS events at cycle 1, day 15. After cycle 2 and beyond, there really are almost no CRS events. And the response rate in this larger study was 78% with a CR rate of 60% with a very fast time to response. In terms of the durability of response, the median PFS, the 24-month PFS is 48%. The median overall survival is 87%. And patients were evaluated by tumor mutation status to by whole exome sequencing to assess whether patients with known prognostic variants were more or less sensitive to mosunetuzumab. And single nucleotide variants were found to have similar frequency to reported prevalence rates. And clinically meaningful responses to mosunetuzumab were basically observed in patients who had common mutations, including those such as T53 that are associated with a poor prognosis, or BCL2 or CREMBP. So in conclusion, mosunetuzumab continued to demonstrate high activity and a very manageable safety profile with no new CRS events and no later chronic toxicities. It had, and I think which is really striking, Dr. Nastupal showed you how remissions tend to be shorter and shorter as you have more and more therapy in follicular lymphoma. Well, in these heavily pretreated patients, mosunetuzumab improved the PFS. So they had a better PFS than they had to their therapy before mosunetuzumab. And mosunetuzumab is now approved. Another bispecific antibody that's being explored in the follicular lymphoma space is odronextamab, which is another CD20, CD3 bispecific, was investigated in a phase 1 trial called the ELM trial, where it had a very high response rate, 91%, with a CR rate of 72%, and a median PFS that was a little shorter than that of mosun of 17.1 months. This is the phase 2 data of ELM, which looked at this bispecific antibody in multiple cohorts. We'll talk about the follicular cohort today. So these patients also received step-up dosing, as is common really for all bispecifics. And there were two step-up regimens, so the step-up was really optimized to mitigate CRS. In terms of baseline characteristics, again, 48% POD24 positive, median age again 61, 30% prior auto transplant, 71 refractory to last line of therapy. And you can see the safety profile is very similar to mosunetuzumab, with the CRS primarily grade 1 and 2, neutropenia up to grade 4. And here are the cytokine release events. So you can see on the second regimen, the grade 2 CRS was only 7 patients or 11%, and there was only one grade 3 CRS. So the primary CRS events were grade 1. All CRS events with resolved with a median time to resolution that was quite short, 2 days, and no patients needed mechanical ventilation or ICU admission. And these are just ICANS, again, extremely low, so really low, almost no neurologic events. There were infections, which are related primarily to these patients being quite immunocompromised, and some of these were COVID infections, the grade 5 infections. Several of these were COVID infections, but there were infections that these patients had. And then the overall response in this phase 2 study was 81% with a CR of 75%. You can see that almost all patients benefited and that the responses were consistent across high-risk subgroups, with a duration of response at 18 months, that was 55%, by independent central review. So the median DOR is 20 months. And the progression-free survival is 20 months as well, with the median overall survival not reached. So in conclusion, similar to mosunetuzumab, odronextamab, these are both off the shelf, so you can basically just take them out of your pharmacy and give them to your patient. This is not FDA approved yet, but like mosunetuzumab, it has a high overall response rate with quite durable responses for many patients. With its step-up regimen, it has a very manageable safety profile with CRS primarily grade 1 and no cases of ICANS or TLS. And there will be phase 3 studies that will, I'm sure, lead to this drug's registration. Epcoritamab is a little different than the other two drugs in that epcoritamab is a subcutaneous bispecific, while the other two drugs are intravenous bispecifics. So epcoritamab has single agent activity in follicular lymphoma, but it's also being explored in combination with R-squared or lenalidomide and Rituxan. There has been already a study called EPCOR-NHL-2, arm 2A, which showed that this combination was safe and led to high response rates. And you can see here that the median duration of response not reached with 100% overall response rate and 96% CMR. This is further data in the EPCOR 2R, and you can see that patients get Rituxan for 5 cycles. They take lenalidomide per standard, and they get epcoritamab subcutaneously every cycle. And they, prior to this, got step-up dosing of EPCO, as is now standard for all bispecifics. Again, very similar patient population, older, in their 60s, heavily pretreated, double refractory, and a high number of POD24 positive patients. Safety profile, so no tumor lysis was observed. There was one patient who had ICANS grade 1, which took 7 days to resolve. And you can see that neutropenia was the primary toxicity. COVID-19 was also a significant toxicity. And that CRS, although frequent, was primarily grade 1 to 2. Here's the CRS events. So CRS grade 1 is 33%, a very low number of grade 2, no grade 3. All CRS resolved, again, with 2 days of onset, and they only 8 patients required treatment with TOCI. No patients needed to discontinue. And again, this data fully supports outpatient administration of this sub-Q therapy, which has high response rates similar to the others, 95% with an 80% CMR, and ongoing treatment here in 88% of patients with a short median time to response of 1.4 months. So patients benefit quickly and continue to benefit for a long period of time. And they just show nice responses across all high-risk subgroups that were consistent. And median response duration now not reached, with a median follow-up that's still short, 5.6 months. And median PFS is not reached. So similar to the other bispecifics, EPCO R-squared, now you see a bispecific in combination, plays well in the sandbox, so it combines very well with an existing therapy for follicular lymphoma that Dr. Nastupal showed you. So remember the relevance trial of R-squared versus chemo. Well, now think about if you added a bispecific to R-squared, how that would compare to chemo. Well, this is a question that's actually being asked, especially when you see such high response rates and high CR rates. Can you move this earlier into earlier lines of treatment? And that is something that is actively being explored with all three bispecifics. So this is now a study that's of epcoritamab, although the other two bispecifics have similar studies in patients who are untreated combined with R-squared. And that that study showed similar tolerability. With no clinical lysis syndrome, only one patient had ICANS, and you can see that the CRS is all grade 1 to 2. No grade 3 CRS, primarily grade 1 to 2 CRS, and very, very high rates of overall and complete metabolic response. with deep responses and a high duration of response. So in this early study, EPCO R-squared showed promising efficacy and a good safety profile. And this is certainly going to be explored as a chemo-free option in previously untreated follicular lymphoma. So in conclusion, harnessing the immune system to target follicular lymphoma is yielding exciting novel therapies and combinations. Bispecific antibodies combine well with other agents and appear to have additive or synergistic effects, such as epcoritamab, lenalidomide, and rituxan, or there's high overall response rate, and responders tend to have a very long duration of response. Bispecific active antibodies have a high activity as a class with minimal toxicity compared to CAR T, especially now with step-up dosing, and they are all appropriate to give in the outpatient setting, except for glofitamab, which is a unique bispecific with a 2-to-1 rather than a 1-to-1 design, and is not really used in the follicular lymphoma space. I think across this class, the duration of response for responders is extremely long. So the question really is, what is the optimal placement in the treatment paradigm? And should these drugs be given earlier in combination with R-squared or other things? It's not clear that patients who have bendamustine, despite the fact that their T-cells are less fit, are having suboptimal responses to bispecific antibodies, which is interesting because there's emerging data that bendamustine too close to CAR may actually impair response to CAR. And I think more data is going to have to be explored in terms of the relationship of T cell fitness from bendamustine to bispecific antibodies. And finally, I think it will be really important going forward to have biomarkers to stratify patients to optimal therapy. Who should get a bispecific up front? Who is this overkill for? Who would benefit in relapse from a CAR versus a bispecific? How should these be sequenced? These are some of the important questions I think that are going to move the field forward over the next 10 years or so. Okay, I'll now move to your questions. Okay, I have a question for Dr. Nastupal. If I have a patient who I believe is a candidate for CAR T therapy, are there guidelines to guide decisions on which approved agent to use?
That's a good question. So the short answer is no. I think each center that's a designated CAR delivery site makes that decision. There are patient-specific characteristics in a center like ours where we have the opportunity to prescribe either axi-cel or tisa-cel. It's going to have to do with the performance status of the patient, the comorbidities, given that the tisa-cel construct is a little bit better in terms of toxicity. That's how we might approach that. But in general, it's going to, again, be center-specific, and there are no national guidelines to help answer that question.
So I think here is one about bispecifics. I'll answer two because one is very short. Is CRS toxicity only of concern at time of initial treatment? So I think this is a very important question, particularly as eventually these therapies will be given in the community as well. All of the CRS appears to occur really in cycle one, often at this first high dose, but sometimes at the first dose of the step-up dose. So all three of those initial doses in cycle one, the day one, day eight, and day 15, you need to watch very carefully the patient. After that, the risk of CRS is exceedingly small, and a patient who hasn't had CRS in cycle one will not have CRS in cycles two or later. In fact, the only patients who have CRS in cycle two were patients who had grade two CRS in cycle one. The next question, which is also, I think, related to CRS, are steroids always given preemptively prior to starting a bispecific? Are there other management strategies that can be employed to decrease the risk of CRS at the start of treatment? That's a very good question. So I think step-up dosing is really the primary way that we mitigate toxicity with bispecifics. On clinical trials, their patients are always required to receive steroids. For my patients who are in, you know, later cycles, and I feel like this is, you know, not really clinically indicated, I take them down to 12.5 milligrams of dex, so I give them as little steroid as I can. And I think there are now guidelines that you can, if your patient has tolerated the bispecific, that after cycle two, you do not need to give steroids. So for a patient who I think follow the guidelines, but I think steroids are certainly something you would need to give in the first two cycles. And after that, if you have the latitude, you probably don't need to give them. Which patient will benefit most from mosunetuzumab? Where does this treatment option fit in the current treatment paradigm? So mosunetuzumab is a an extremely well-tolerated therapy that is highly active. So I would say any patient who currently fits the label, and that's who has relapsed after, who's in the third line, who doesn't have a clinical trial option, should be offered mosunetuzumab. It's easy to give. It doesn't interrupt your life. You can basically get it and you know, go back to work the next day. Who would I not give mosunetuzumab to? A patient who was a trial candidate in a trial that had a bispecific in combination, like a EPCO R-squared trial or a Mosin Pola trial, or because I think, you know, our trials are how we've developed these exciting drugs that Dr. Nastupal and I have brought to you today. And without trials to move the field forward and bring these drugs to patients before they're approved, we wouldn't have any more advances. And there are so many exciting drug combinations of drugs we know are safe that I would probably offer a patient a clinical trial before mosunetuzumab. But let's say they weren't a trial candidate. I think the question then becomes bispecific or CAR. For most patients, I would probably offer bispecific before CAR. The exception might be someone who was very young with very aggressive lymphoma, or someone who I was concerned had transformed lymphoma. Because remember that these therapies are only approved for patients with follicular lymphoma grade 1 to 3A. So if I had any concern for transformation, I would probably not feel that that patient could benefit from mosunetuzumab. As many more BiTEs get approved, even though CRS is minimal, there is a risk. Toci is still only approved for CAR T products. How would you address CRS on patients not on trials for BiTE?
Yeah, I think it's important first to recognize where is the patient in that treatment schema, meaning is it their first exposure? Is it, are they at full dose? Have they had prior CRS before? So for instance, if this is a patient who just had their first cycle one, day one at a low dose, and they're having their first onset of fever, I do kind of want to know if, you know, they are high risk for developing grade two or higher. Most are going to have fever and that's it. Those patients, I think you could potentially manage with something like an antipyretic, such as the acetaminophen, for instance. If, however, this is a patient who's getting full dose, they may have had grade one CRS previously, they may have high tumor burden, and I'm worried they're going to progress from grade one to grade two. Those are patients I might be on the ready to have corticosteroids available to them with their first onset of fever. If I have a patient that they have CRS, they're in our facility, either inpatient or in our infusion center, and they also have hypoxia or hypotension. Now we're in the grade two or higher arena. That's when I'm going to reach for tocilizumab. And though, yes, it's FDA approved for CAR T cell therapy, in all of our trials for the management of CRS, I should specify, in all of our trials, there was the option of using institutional standards that you could apply to the bispecific CRS that's already in place for your CRS management for CAR T. And in most centers, I say tocilizumab is utilized in grade two or higher CRS. I think the tricky thing for all of us is as we roll out these sort of treatment algorithms for our standard of care patients, anticipating they're going to be a little bit sicker and frailer than what was seen on the prospective study, is when will people react to that fever and utilize things like corticosteroids and or tocilizumab. I suspect at first we'll probably react a little bit more strongly. And then as we gain more experience and have our workflow sorted out for how to transition patients that need to be hospitalized from an outpatient to inpatient setting, I think we'll get more comfortable with utilizing less aggressive measures, because that's what happened with CAR T.
One very quick one. Someone asked the overall age of the patients in the polatuzumab study. It was 64, and there was a range of from young to in the late 80s. So it was a very well-tolerated therapy as well. Now, the next one, I think, given the rapid advances in treatment modalities, how would you treat POD24 disease and what would govern your sequence regimen? I think this is very similar to the mosunetuzumab question, just sort of phrased differently. I think the first question really is, has the patient relapsed with follicular lymphoma or do they have transformed disease? Then by that, I mean transformed into an aggressive large cell lymphoma. because that takes you down two different treatment paradigms. So all of these therapies we're talking about, the POLA, obinutuzumab rituxan, the R-squared, the bispecific antibodies, are for patients with grade 1 to 3A disease. So these are not therapies for patients with transformed follicular lymphoma. If the patient has transformed follicular lymphoma, they should be treated as a DLBCL patient and taken down a DLBCL treatment paradigm, which in second line would most likely be CAR T therapy. If the patient is POD24 positive but continues to have follicular lymphoma histology, you have many options at this time, including R-squared, if they got R-chemo to start, R-chemo if they got R-squared to start, clinical trial, polatuzumab combinations, bispecifics alone, bispecifics in combination, and CAR-T. So I think all of those, you know, are excellent options. And I'll ask Dr. Nastupal if she wants to add anything.
Yeah, I think, as you said earlier, I think for the field, the most important thing we need to do right now is support trials for these patients, because this is the unmet need. And so I'm going to choose a trial first and foremost for these patients. If a trial is not an option, or if I'm practicing in a setting where clinical trial is just not feasible, then I think it does depend a little bit on what their prior treatment was. How worried am I that they have aggressive histology concurrently? And so if, for instance, the most common scenario is a patient had been bendamustine rituximab frontline, they're relapsing early, I've biopsied them and proven that there's no signs of large cell lymphoma, then your question in my mind is, do you give R-CHOP or do you give something like lenalidomide and rituximab? So it depends a little bit on the age and frailty of the patient. If there's someone I'm worried is not going to tolerate an anthracycline-based approach, I'm going to prefer R-squared in that setting. If, however, it's someone that's young and fit, and I really am concerned they have occult transformation, I just didn't prove it on the biopsy, meaning LDH is high. They may even have hypercalcemia. They have the B symptoms. SUVs are higher on that. Then I'm going to proceed with R-CHOP in my second line.
That is all the time we have today. Thank you very much for your attention. On behalf of Dr. Nastupal and myself, thank you so much for joining us.